Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Steve McWhorter, and I'm an attorney for the appellants in this case, the Northwest Entities. My attorney number is 41148. This appeal hinges on one question. Can an arbitrator make the determination that the parties agreed to arbitrate where one party disputes any agreement at all, and the evidence demonstrates that the parties never reached an agreement?
Well, Mr. McWhorter, let me ask you about that. Didn't the arbitrator in this case say that the parties asked me to determine the issue of arbitrability, and that under Rule R7 of the AAA, he had the power to do that?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't remember his exact words, but he said something to that effect.
And by participating in that arbitration, didn't you waive any objection to the arbitrator, in fact, using Rule R7 to make that determination?
No, Your Honor. The Northwest Entities did not waive that right. They objected to the arbitrability of this dispute from the beginning. They objected to it months before the pretrial hearing. They objected to it at the hearing.
I understand that. But how did that preserve your right to go to the district court? Why didn't you just go down to the district court and ask for injunctive relief?
I can't answer that question as to why they didn't. I do know that they were not represented by counsel at that time. They preserved that right as far as they could, and once it was made very clear to them that the issue was going to be arbitrated, they had really no choice at all. They made the objection as many times as they could. They objected so long that the arbitrator took away their right to issue their counterclaims, which is one of the reasons that they really want this issue decided by the courts here in Colorado. Once the arbitrator decided that there was no way this wasn't going to be arbitrated, they had essentially to choose just to let the issue go without them and waive any ability to defend themselves, and there was no guarantee that a Colorado court would listen to their arguments in the future. So essentially, like I said, they had no decision to make at all. They objected as long as they could, and then they had to play along and appeal this issue at a later date when they had the opportunity to get in front of the district court. Both the United States and the Colorado Supreme Courts have held that a party cannot be compelled to arbitrate without a clear agreement to do so. They have also held that where a party challenges the existence of an agreement to arbitrate, the dispute must be decided by the court and not the arbitrator. Access to the courts is one of the inherent functions in our judicial system, and the courts need to strictly construe any purported agreements to waive that right.
Mr. McWhorter, would you agree that during the exchange of agreements, as it were, that all of the disagreements were basically about the retainer, not about the possible arbitration?
No, Your Honor. I will agree that they were not about the arbitration clause, but they were not about solely the retainer. They were about the scope of the agreement. Only one of the Northwest entities was in litigation at that moment. They were trying to have the other parties added to that claim, and that was part of the issue, is they needed to make sure that they had the issues with all three of the entities addressed by their expert, but at the same time they didn't want to go ahead and spend a lot of money on that until they had an answer as to whether those parties were going to be added. So the dispute had to do with the retainer. It had to do with whether Mr. Rote was going to sign on behalf of all three entities, one entity, whether he was going to sign personally, and there's another issue, and I apologize, it left my mind right now. But no.
Well, can I just follow up with that? There's nothing in the record that showed an express disagreement over the arbitration clause.
And the Northwest entities, I believe, would have agreed to arbitrate if they had ever reached an agreement. They said that to the arbitrator when they sent a letter. I believe it was an attorney, Mitchell Roth, sent a letter to the arbitrator who even proposed an agreement to arbitrate, but only with the with Northwest Direct Teleservices. But that offer was never accepted by, the arbitrator never really entertained it, and Harper Hofer never accepted that.
Excuse me for interrupting you. I hope I didn't bother your train of thought. I want to follow up on that point, Mr. McWhorter. During the course of this exchange, did someone call the expert and say, don't do any work because we don't have a deal, so we don't want you to involve yourself in any respect until we get a deal? Or was the situation such that you knew full well that work was being done to prepare for the expert testimony all during the time that you exchanged writings?
Well, my review of the record does not show any telephone calls that were made. However, there were emails sent back and forth, emails that Melinda Harper of Harper Hofer acknowledged that she was not going to do any further work. Mr. Rote asked her not to.
Any further work or any work, period?
Any further work. There was an understanding that she did do work, and the Northwest entities don't dispute the fact that work was done. They don't dispute the fact that she has a potential, or that Harper Hofer has a potential quantum Merowit claim or other potential avenues to collect for the work that they've done. They dispute whether that has, those funds have been earned due to other issues, but there's no dispute that they did work. What they dispute here solely is that the issue should be decided by the arbitrator and not by the courts. They have malpractice claims that they wish to bring that the arbitrator did not allow them to bring, and they want that issue decided by the district court, as is their right. Harper Hofer and the district court both relied on a number of fraudulent inducement cases to argue that the arbitrator is the one to make the determination. However, that rationale behind those decisions is that while they may have been fraudulently induced to sign the agreement in its entirety, so long as there was no dispute as to the arbitrability clause itself, then there was no dispute about that. But that rationale does not apply here, where they never reached any agreement at all. And I will note that the district court itself found that there was no agreement reached. It explicitly found that there was no written agreement, and then it noted that, and I'll quote, there is a real question whether the parties ever entered into an enforceable contract, i.e. whether the contract exists at all. The court never did answer that question. It left it out there, but the court made its decision solely on the fact that it found that the arbitrator had the sole jurisdiction to determine whether the arbitrability clause was enforceable or not.
Well, did he determine that it had the sole jurisdiction or that it had proper jurisdiction under Rule R7?
And thank you, Your Honor. The court found that the arbitrator had proper jurisdiction.
So by affirming the arbitration, the court of necessity approved of the conclusion that the arbitrator came to.
The court decided that it did not have jurisdiction to make the determination. The court found that the arbitrator had that jurisdiction and did so. But like I said, the law in Colorado and, you know, under U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence, that any question to the arbitration clause itself, which this challenge to the existence of any agreement certainly is a question for the court, not the arbitrator. And as such, the arbitrator's decision essentially doesn't exist. The court can't be bound by it, and the court needs to make its own findings of fact in order to reach the conclusion that is an arbitrable dispute. I'll note that Harper Hofer also argues that the parties reached an implied in fact contract, but the parties, as you'll see in the briefs, I'm sure you've seen in the briefs, sent numerous emails back and forth, and it's obvious that they never did reach an agreement as to the terms of the purported representation by Harper Hofer. Northwest Entities expressly asked Harper Hofer not to continue any work until an agreement was reached, and Harper Hofer acknowledged that they did not have an agreement and agreed to stop work until they could reach an agreement. While it's possible for the parties to reach an implied contract without a written document, the evidence is clear in this case that they never reached such an agreement. The district court, like I said, acknowledged as much in its own order. The Northwest Entities are not seeking to avoid responsibility for legitimate fees incurred. Instead, they dispute the fees and simply ask that the dispute be decided by the courts, not by the arbitrator, and they've never wavered from that position. The parties never agreed to arbitrate. Northwest Entities never agreed to submit this dispute to arbitration. Colorado and federal law are both clear that only the court can make the determination to arbitrability, and the district court did not make that finding. Instead, they found that the arbitrator made that determination and that the court did not have the authority to overturn that determination. Because that finding was incorrect as a matter of law, Northwest Entities ask you to reverse the court's order. Thank you.
Thank you. You have about 4 minutes left for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Dan Wartell, and I'm here on behalf of Harper Hofer, the appellee. The court has three independent bases upon which it could affirm the trial court. One being the consent to arbitration, two being the existence of an express contract, and three being the implied in fact contract. I think the court need go no further than the consent issue, because here, as we set forth in our briefs, the record is clear that both parties, all of the parties to this action, voluntarily and expressly submitted the question of arbitrability to the arbitrator. And that's reflected in the record. And I'll just give the court a couple pinpoint sites. Page 97 of the record is the email from Mr. Rote to the arbitrator, Arbitrator Wilson, where he specifically states, for efficiency purposes, we have asked AAA to make that decision and for you to acknowledge that there was no executed contract. There must be offer and acceptance, and if the contract and the contract fails overall in this regard. And the arbitrator's understanding of what had been submitted to him is reflected in his order concerning arbitrability, which can be found in the record at page 32 and 33, where the arbitrator specifically says, this matter comes before me on respondents, which would have been the appellant in this proceeding, motion for a determination of whether each of the three respondents is bound to arbitrate the current dispute with the claimant. That's the language that Judge Graham referred to. So we have in the record the request by the appellant, and we also have the understanding reflected by the arbitrator that he had been specifically asked to determine the issue of arbitrability. And under the case law that we've cited, regardless of whether there is an agreement made or not, the fact that the parties were in an arbitration proceeding and voluntarily consented to have the arbitrator determine that issue, I believe, is dispositive, and that's why the trial court gave the very deferential standard of review, because it wasn't looking at the merits of the case. It was saying this is a matter that's come before the arbitrator, was in within the arbitrator's jurisdiction, and assuming that none of the factors that are present in the statutory reasons for a trial court to reverse an arbitration award, absent one of those very narrow factors, I simply don't have the discretion to look back and second guess the arbitrator's.
Mr. Wartell, let me just ask you one question. My understanding from the record is that the agreement to arbitrate was conditioned on, we are objecting for purposes of appeal to submit this to arbitration, but given that we preserve that for purposes of appeal, we'll go ahead. And my question for you is, what legal effect does that have?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that what the legal effect has is that the law doesn't allow people to avail themselves of the jurisdiction of a court or an arbitrator, for example, by these respondent or by the appellant's assertion of counterclaims in the arbitration. So the legal impact that I think that has is you can't kind of avail yourself. And if you're happy with the result, you say, okay, I'm happy with this. And if you're not, you preserve your right to get a second bite at the apple with the court. And I think that leads into the next point that I wanted to make, which is both in the briefs and in oral argument, the appellant has said they really had no choice. At the point in time where the arbitrator determined his own jurisdiction and said, we're going forward with arbitration, that they were left with no choice but to continue to proceed. And that's wrong because, Your Honors, in the same way under 1322207, that someone who seeks to compel arbitration may go to a district court and in a summary proceeding determine that arbitrability question. 1322207 subsection 2 is the inverse, and that gives the respondent to an arbitration the ability to go to the district court and seek a stay of the arbitration proceeding. So the notion that there were no procedural or substantive tools at the appellant's disposal to get this determination by a court that they're asking for now is simply inconsistent with what the law is.
And that statutory provision requires the court to proceed forthwith to summarily determine the question.
That's right. And the specific language, it's short and it may be of use, is on the, this is subsection 2, on the motion of a person alleging that an arbitration proceeding has been initiated or threatened, but that there is not an agreement to arbitrate, the court shall proceed summarily to decide the issue. If the court finds that there is an enforceable agreement to arbitrate, it shall order the parties to arbitrate. So there's a clear legal remedy available to the respondents at the time that this issue first arose, and rather than availing themselves of that, they chose to begrudgingly participate in the arbitration proceeding, and it was not until they received an unfavorable ruling that they proceeded with judicial review of the arbitrability question. I want to spend a little bit of time and just focus on the trial court's order and the language that's referenced throughout the opening brief and the reply brief, and that was also mentioned in the oral argument, and that's the findings that were made by the trial court. And I actually want to be a little bit more precise with the language, because I don't believe that the trial court, the district court, ever made a finding about whether or not there was or was not an agreement to arbitrate. The quote that the appellant has locked onto is the dispute that says there is a real question whether the parties ever entered into an enforceable agreement, i.e. whether the contract exists at all. That's the language that the appellants are latching onto, but the court needs to look at the context in which this was made. The trial court was going through an analysis about what's within the province of the court and what's within the province of the arbitrator as to the arbitrability issue. And what the court does is analogizes this issue about arbitrability, given the context that we were in, with fraudulent inducement cases, where even though an agreement can be induced or be the product of inducement by fraud, the only question under the separability doctrine that Colorado follows is, was the agreement to arbitrate induced by fraud? And if it was not, then there's an agreement to arbitrate and the overall effect, validity, or enforceability of the contract as a whole is left to the arbitrator to decide. That's the point that the trial court was trying to make. And he specifically says, the district court says, after citing to these fraudulent inducement cases, the same logic applies here. There is a real question. In other words, there may be a dispute about whether the total contract is valid and enforceable, and under all of the law that both parties have cited, that's within the province of the arbitrator. The only question before the trial court was whether or not the parties agreed to arbitrate the dispute. And what the trial court found was that regardless of which competing draft was going back and forth, regardless of the communication or the conduct of the parties, there was never any disagreement about the arbitration provision. And there were not one, but two separate engagement letters, the contracts that were signed by Mr. Rhode. And I understand on appeal, he's arguing that he has no recollection of signing one of the two written agreements, but there was not one, but two separate signed agreements with certain language that related specifically to the retainer struck out. But there was no question about the party's agreement to arbitrate. And I would also suggest to the court that in addition to inviting the arbitrator to determine the question of arbitrability, if we move away from that issue and towards the actual merits or substance of the dispute, Mr. Rhodes' testimony, which can be found at page 129 of the record, lines 8 through 14, his question was, so as of October 10th, you had no concerns over the language of the engagement letter, and you have affirmatively stated to Ms. Harper that you were planning on paying the invoices that week. Answer, that's correct. So to get to Judge Graham's question again about the conduct or what was going on, the conduct evidences assent by Mr. Rowe. Not only is he saying he has no problems with the language of the agreement, but he's also making affirmative statements such as, I promise I will pay you next week. That's conduct which leads to our implied in fact agreement. There's no question that services were rendered. There's no question that those services had value. There's no factual dispute that at least two engagement agreements were signed. And there's no question that Mr. Rote received the value of those services. One last point I want to make, Your Honors, which is the significance or lack of significance to the fact that there were these competing drafts going back and forth in a dispute about who signed what when. The law in Colorado is clear, and we've cited to the E21 case, which is 252 P3rd 36. And what that case stands for is the simple proposition that an agreement to arbitrate, just like any other agreement outside of the statute of frauds or limited exceptions, does not need to be in writing. And when the court looks at the drafts that went back and forth, in addition to the two signed agreements, getting back to the issue of there never being a question or a dispute about the arbitrability, I think the facts of this case show, and the conduct of the parties allows certainly for the reasonable inference that regardless of the effect of a written agreement, the parties clearly understood what the terms were that they were proposing back and forth to one another, and whether they had a certain dispute on one limited term, which was ultimately resolved to the party's satisfaction, as expressed in the October 10th, the testimony from Mr. Rope concerning his state of mind as of October 10th. There's no question that there was a party, an agreement to arbitrate. The last issue is just our request for attorney's fees. Both pursuant to the party's contract, assuming this court should find that the trial court was correct, the arbitrator awarded attorney's fees both up to the point of the arbitration and also going forward with respect to costs of collection and other attorney's fees that may be incurred by the appellee, in addition to the statutory authority that we've set in our brief for attorney's fees on appeal. So we would request that the court affirm the district court's ruling, and to the extent that it finds that we are the prevailing party, to remand to the district court for a determination of reasonable attorney's fees on the appeal, unless the panel has any other questions. Okay, thank you.
I just want to briefly address Mr. Wartell's arguments. As I was listening to him talk, it struck me that you either have an agreement or you don't have an agreement. And like the old saying goes, you can't be a little bit pregnant. And they're saying because we never disputed the arbitration clause specifically, that doesn't mean that the parties ever reached an agreement if they never reach an agreement on the underlying contract.
Yeah, Mr. McWhorter, before you run out of time, could you address the argument about statute 1322-207-2?
And I apologize, I forget exactly which statute part of the arbitration code that.
That's where Mr. Wartell argued that instead of just submitting to arbitration, that you had no choice, that you could have obtained a determination.
Oh, yes. And that was certainly an option. And, you know, I'm sure that had the Northwest entities been represented by counsel, they would have entertained that option and they may have gone that way. However, they did not, but that does not give jurisdiction where jurisdiction does not exist. You cannot waive the right to arbitrate without an agreement, and the Northwest entities have always maintained to the arbitrator, to the court, and to Harper Hofer that there was never an agreement to submit to arbitrate. The district court, contrary to what Mr. Wartell said, did find that there was no written agreement. The court did say that there is a genuine question as to whether any agreement exists at all. The court didn't answer that question, but the court cannot affirm the arbitrator's decision without answering that question. At the least, this court should remand this case back to the district court to make that determination. I would really ask the court to follow up on the district court's order and find that there was no agreement, but the court certainly has either option when reversing this case, as I ask you to do. Mr. Wartell pointed out or argued that the fraudulent inducement cases cited by both Harper Hofer and the district court essentially follow the same logic, or this situation should follow the same logic as those fraudulent inducement cases. However, again, in those fraudulent inducement cases, the parties did demonstrate a willingness to arbitrate the contract. Here, they never did demonstrate that willingness to do so because they never reached an agreement. At most, the Northwest entities demonstrated that they were willing to arbitrate once an agreement was reached, but they needed to agree on the terms of that agreement before they would be willing to waive their access to the courts. Because of the deference given to an arbitration award by the courts, I would represent to you that the courts need to strictly construe any purported agreements to waive that access. Once that access is waived, there's no going back, and there's essentially no appeals process, and the court needs to be very strict in construing that initial waiver. Once again, Northwest is not arguing that work wasn't done. They did not receive any value for the work that was done. They never did receive a report. They never had any opportunity to use any of the work that was done by Harper Hofer. That being said, that issue is not really relevant to this case. Harper Hofer can pursue their remedies in the court system, and that's what I ask you to allow them to do. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I'd like to thank both counsel for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.